grammar nerd?
I'm a grammar nerd.
And I want to clarify. I meant when I said you're a grammar nerd with like the apostrophe R-E.
Yes, yes. My mom was an English teacher.
That'll do it.
Yeah.
I worry then if you've looked at my writing because I'm not terrible, but I'm not great. I actually, ironically enough, in my Roger Ebert memorial,
yeah.
I mentioned that I have grammatical errors, and I actually made a grammatical error within that sentence.
Unintentionally?
Completely unintentionally.
See, it would have been good if it was
intentional. Yeah, that would have been good. Unfortunately, I'm just not that clever. I am, however, that sloppy.
So is your building. There was an error on your sign.
Is there?
It said something about don't tailgate because that is a breach in security. Breach. B-R-E-E-C-H.
Oh, man.
And I'm like,
I'm going to fill out a form. Well, welcome to wherever you are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to episode 84 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. If I sound a little weary tonight, it's because I'm not far out of Hot Docs Film Festival, and if you've been listening to the show for any length of time, you know that first show after a film festival is kind of a rough go, so hopefully there's not too much rust shaking off me tonight, but it's all okay because we got a first-time guest, and I think probably the first friend that I've made through Twitter. The first actual friend I've made through Twitter. I have other followers and that kind of thing and people who I've picked up, but nobody who's actually like come and said hey and been on the show and you know you helped me with Christmas gifts and that kind of thing. So and just to make things more interesting, she doesn't even write about movies all that much. She's actually my Broadway friend, my theater nerd friend. We are live tonight in Casa del McNeil. We are welcoming Kelly Cameron to the show. How are you?
Good, thank you. Yourself?
I am. I'm well. As I said, I think I'm back in One Piece. Certainly going to a 10 o'clock showing of our movie today. Didn't really help that, but we got a weekend and it'll all be okay. On episode 84, we'll be discussing The Great Gatsby. We'll be taking listener feedback on parties, and there's a lot of feedback on parties. And we'll turn the record over to Play the Other Side. First, though, we need to learn more about Kelly. This is Know Your Enemy. This is where you go on the hot seat. So, what's one of the first films you can remember seeing in a theater?
In a theater, Jurassic Park.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you remember anything about like the experience? Like your parents probably took you, right?
Yep, my dad took me. It was the first movie I saw alone with my father. My mom took my little sister to see something more family friendly, and my dad took me to see Jurassic Park. And I do remember the experience because when the I think it was when the raptors were attacking near the end. My father thought it would be a brilliant idea to reach underneath my seat and grab it and you know, shoot me up. And I screamed really loud and we almost got thrown out of the movie theater. So, yeah, thus began my fear of scary movies and why I won't go see them in the movie theater.
Still, to this day?
Still. Will not see a scary movie.
You know nobody's going to screw with your seat now, right?
Yeah, but it doesn't matter.
The damage is done.
It's irreparable.
Oh, wow. The rest of it went okay? Were you scared the rest of it? Because it is kind of a freaky movie.
Yeah, I mean, I was tense. I mean, I'd already seen The Shining at that point because my parents thought it was smart to show that to a young child.
Okay.
So I liked scary movies and I appreciated them, but it was different on the big screen.
Yeah, well, it's more immersive, right?
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Plus, my dad was known for doing crazy stuff like that, so I was probably tense through all of it, waiting for him to make his move.
Right, yeah. Right. Nice. Well, besides Gatsby, because obviously that's the answer, what was the last movie you watched?
Oh, I just saw Looper.
Oh, yeah, okay. What'd you think of Looper?
I was distracted by the fact that Joseph Gordon-Levitt didn't look like Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
He looks like Bruce Willis.
Well, sure. I assume that's what they were going for.
That is exactly what they were going for. His nose, a little bit on the chin. I think they monkeyed with his hairline. I could be wrong on that. And certainly his eye color.
Yeah.
All designed to make him look like Bruce Willis, which for me paid off in that diner scene where they're facing each other.
Yes, that it was cool. The rest of the time, though, I was just like, why does Joseph Gordon-Levitt look so weird? And so, I knew that's what they were going for, but it was distracting.
And so distracting that you couldn't even form an opinion? Or?
No, I still I still enjoyed the movie.
Okay.
I love Emily Blunt, so that was a big win for me.
She's one of those actresses who, if she's in the movie, I'm automatically interested.
Yeah.
Like, she was in, like, some fluffy little thing called Sunshine Cleaning, which she was with Amy Adams. And it's not really good, but she's good in it. And so it's one of those things where I was like, I'm not really digging this, but I'm watching Emily Blunt. I'm enjoying that. So, no, same thing. When she showed up, basically when the whole thing moved to the farm, I was really, really interested because I don't think I was expecting that.
No, and she, I don't know, I find she elevates most things that she's in.
Yeah.
So I was like, ooh, I didn't even know she was in it because Looper kind of was just off my radar, probably because it was in the vein of scary. So I wasn't going to see it at the movie theater. So I was like, oh, look, Emily Blunt.
I think we're happening upon a new little runner or a meme. You, any movie that you're kind of even halfway interested in, you need to put it out to the masses.
Yeah.
How scary is this?
Yes, on a scale of 1 to 10. Yes. Will I survive the movie theater experience without embarrassing myself?
Exactly.
That's how it usually goes.
Cool.
Yeah.
What's one of the worst films you've ever seen?
Worst, just as in a film that I hated, or...
Yep.
Oh...
Terrible, dumb, waste of time.
Dude, Where's My Car?
And
I know a lot of people loved it, but I was like, seriously?
I actually have never seen that. I don't think I ever will. Let me guess. You saw that in the theater, didn't you?
I think I did. Probably dragged by a boy.
I was going to say, somebody dragged you?
Yep. That was probably payback for a bad chick flick, but...
Yeah, but that's... No, like, you want to get the even up, like... I think about this when I get the even up on a chick flick, I go for like James Bond or I go for like Zero Dark Thirty. I'm not, you know, dragging somebody to see Dude, Where's My Car?
The problem with that though is that like I like films, so
A
smart guy knows that like it's not payback to drag me to James Bond. Dude, Where's My Car was payback.
Oh man.
Because there were very few redeeming qualities in that.
Yeah, the funny thing is, I do like, kind of not quoting the movie, but I will use the term, dude, where's my, like, fill in the blank at work. So, like, I'll be like, dude, where's my report?
Okay.
I'm quite proud to say that I never saw Dude, Where's My Car. Did you even make it through it? Did you, like, fall asleep? Were you...
I did not. I have never fallen asleep in a movie theater.
Oh, okay. That's good. So, you're one up on me.
Yeah. Not in a movie theater.
That's happened once or twice. And that was, like, back before the days of, like, even being able to, like, check your BlackBerry.
Really?
Okay. Well, no, wasn't it? Like, that was...
Yeah, well, I guess that wasn't that long ago.
Dude, Where's My Car? It feels like it was
longer. Yeah, that one was.
No, not recently. But I mean, yeah, when you're seeing Dude, Where's My Car, if you were bored in Dude, Where's My Car and it came out now, then at the very least, maybe you could, like, and I do not advocate this, but in this case, I'll make an exception. You know, you could, like, play with your BlackBerry or something like that, or check your email, or catch up on work or something.
True.
But back then, because I think it was around 2001?
I think so.
So even though the technology was there, certainly, like, the messaging just was not.
No.
You were in it.
I was screwed.
Yeah.
And to be fair, I'm ballsier now. I would just leave and go into another theater.
Okay.
You know, especially if that person was my ride. Like, you just enjoy this movie. I'm going to go to the bathroom / sneaking in to see something better.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. What is a classic or essential film that you have not seen?
I still haven't watched all the way through Doctor Strangelove.
Really?
Yes.
Well, so wait a minute. You started it, and then what happened?
Most of the time I was trying to watch it, and then my parents stopped me because they didn't want me watching it.
Wait a minute.
I was
the same pair that took you to the dinosaur movie and freaked you out while you were there.
Yeah.
Thought that Doctor Strangelove was somehow inappropriate.
Yes.
I've seen that movie. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, I don't know what the reasoning behind that was. I do recall being stopped numerous times, mostly by my mother. Not so much my dad. He loved it. It was one of his favorite movies.
Right.
So
There's a one scene, and it's not even all that explicit, but there's a woman in a bikini. Was your mom, like, ultra-conservative?
She was ultra-conservative.
That could be it.
It's also entirely possible she had not seen it.
That's also... Okay. It's great. It was... it's a great entry point for Kubrick, because it's really weird comedy. Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room. You know, like, lines like that, which I adore. No, that's a good one. I do think you should eventually...
Yeah, I should probably get on that some point.
Yeah, it's a good one. I like that answer. And yeah, there's good things in store. And I say, see it when nobody's going to stop you. Last but not least, for any rhyme or reason, what's a film that you wish you made?
that I wish I'd made?
Written, directed, produced, any part of it.
Hmm.
I feel like I did send you these questions in advance.
Yeah, but my memory is crap. and my opinions change all the time. All
right.
I'm going to go with Clueless.
Hmm. Okay, I haven't had that answer yet. Why Clueless?
Have you had a lot of females on the program?
Every other show. Every okay. Second show, yes.
Oh, I'm feeling
nice to meet a fan.
I'm feeling girly. Oh, dear. Just because for me personally, maybe it just came out right at the right time, but it had a big impact on me, even though I was, like, in no way like the girls in the film.
Okay.
But my friends and I watched it over and over again and kind of, I think, wished we could be like that, tried to emulate fashion from it. Like, it had a really big impact. And I'd like to make something that had a big impact on that phase of my life because I was so...
Well, there's
crazy. For
it's
it.
Part of a. It's sort of part of a lineage too, right? Like it kind of fits very nicely in between, say, Heathers and Mean Girls.
Yeah.
You know, like they're not all exactly the same story, obviously, but that they're all like the high school story, the group mentality, very smartly written. You know, obviously female driven.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's Jane Austen, of course. Now, does that kind of, that love for Clueless, does that spill over onto Emma as well, or?
I mean, I do love Jane Austen, but, right. You know, I kind of liked what Clueless did and that it got, you know, all the people who would never watch Jane Austen or
yeah.
read Jane Austen, involved, right? And there was that one line where she told her dad that she had gotten a better mark on her paper because she had negotiated, and he said, I couldn't be prouder than if you had gotten the A yourself, and that, you know, that rang true for me because I've argued and negotiated my way into a lot of stuff that I didn't actually deserve. And I think that that movie was pivotal
very nice,
for that.
Very nice.
Yeah.
I like it. So, well done. You know, you reached for your answers, but you've done very, very well. And that is the hardest part of the show. So, there we go. That's Kelly Cameron. Welcome again to the show. And it's now, of course, the time to learn more about you. It's your chance to come talk to me right after this. Why are you shaking like a leaf? Come on, come talk to me. Oh, please talk to me. But I wanted to know, given your choice, what is a party in a movie that you would like to get an invitation to? Like, so what party would you like to go to if such things existed? And there were a lot of responses, so get comfortable, kids. Nikki Newton Platter, a new follower on Facebook, she's in Australia, wants to go to the barbecue at the Wilkes house in Gone with the Wind. I'm not a big fan of Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, it doesn't
but,
do a lot.
But that's got all those like Southern cotillions, so I could
yeah.
see that as a good answer. Justin Moharab said the big party on Endor at the end of Return of the Jedi.
Oh.
Yeah. yeah.
Shout out.
We're all nerds.
All right, sure.
So Aaron, who's in Chicago, he helms a site called Donkey Wrangler to the Stars. He wants to party with, he wants to hang with Peter Sellers in the film The Party, which I've actually never seen.
I have not seen
it. I've heard all kinds of people talk about like how funny it is, but I've never actually put it on. But hey, if it's called a party, you know, and you're an invite to a party, why not, right? Joanna Clubis in New York said the Capulet party in Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, because I love a good costume party where the champagne is flowing. That party was all about excess and great music. Hear, I think.
Yeah.
That's a good, like, that was a film where Baz Luhrmann first got my attention in terms of the lavishness of the design and certainly that party as well.
And the music.
Yeah. The music in that movie is crazy as well. And really well done. He mixes the new and the old very, very nicely. Jonathan Sullivan in Texas said the grad party in Can't Hardly Wait, or, and here's where Jonathan gets in my good books, the fundraiser at the end of Empire Records.
Oh, that was mine.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, we'll come back to that then. We'll come around. Dan Fogarty from Fogue's Movie Review said he can't believe he's the first person to answer the toga party from Animal House.
Nice.
Which I was never part of a fraternity, so that would probably be a learning experience for me. Sean Patrick Kelly said Louis Tully's party in Ghostbusters. Where else can I advise on good deals and get attacked by terror dogs? I seem to remember that party like going on without Lewis.
I don't remember.
Like he was incidental to the whole thing. People were hanging out like basically without him.
Yeah.
Well. So yeah, as one might do. Matt Kowalski from Germany said the lower class dance shindig below decks in Titanic. She thinks that would have been a lot of fun. I also, the one thing I like about that party is they show it in contrast to like the formal affair going on up top.
The stuffiness of the cigar party.
Well, what's the line? You want to go to a real party?
Yeah.
Is that the line?
That is the line.
You're well versed in Titanic.
I am well versed in Titanic. And that was a great.
And you know what? I'm frightened with how well versed I am with Titanic. I pulled that one, no problem. My friend Courtney Small said. Buckle up. My friend Courtney Small said the party that Kid and Play throw in House Party. I think Courtney Small wins this whole contest. Yeah, pretty sure. Anytime you can get Kid and Play into the conversation, you're winning. My friend Simon Collum in London, England said any of Stifler's parties in the American Pie films. Over on the website, I got comments as well. Nick Zara in India said the Yule Ball from Harry Potter or one of Holly Golightly's parties in Breakfast at Tiffany's. Those seems like ragers. Like, I think that half of the people who are there, she doesn't even know.
Yeah.
All those ones?
Yeah.
But and much to the chagrin of the rest of her building.
And I think that's how you do it, though.
Right? Well, yeah. That's the mark of a good
Who are these? The mark of a good party. These people?
Yeah, clearly, I'm not well versed at this. Colin Biggs in Nevada said the get-togethers in Joss Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing are entertaining. I'd step in for that. Did you get to see that at TIFF?
I did not get to see that.
You get your a few weeks. I think it's in mid June. Right? Yeah. They are very handsome party. Like, it's a backyard party. Like, it's a huge yard, but it's all in a backyard, and it's pretty lavish for a small space. It's all in really cool black and white. I think there's like acrobats and fire eaters and that kind of thing. Oh yeah, no. It's no expense was spared, that's for sure. So enjoy that one. And good call, Colin. Andrew Robinson, the G-man in Trinidad, said, "Can I go to the party in Eyes Wide Shut, just to be the guy who screws with Tom Cruise?"
That's good.
And my friend Brian J. Rowan agreed. They both want to go to the masked orgies in Eyes Wide Shut. I say they're pervy bastards.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the reason is to mess with Tom Cruise.
I don't think
good,
that either.
Good on. Stick to your story.
Yeah, that's Fidelio good. Boys.
Yeah.
Corey Pierce said anyone worth their salt would be at the keg party in the Moon Tower from Dazed and Confused. My brother Shane agreed. Actually, Shane said he'd go one further. He wants... Along with going to the party, he wants to be hanging with Matthew McConaughey ahead of time.
Nice.
He wants that to be his ride. He wants to be hanging out outside of the Emporium there. Yeah, a good one. Everybody here approves. Steve Honeywell in Illinois said the Christmas cocktail party from The Thin Man. Great people to talk to. Free-flowing booze. A lot of lushes in this survey, but not like I'm throwing stones. And I get to hang with Myrna Loy in her prime. Nick from Cinema Romantico, also in Illinois, said the Jack Horner hosted parties in Boogie Nights. Another pervy bastard. Pretty sure I wouldn't want to go make a habit of it. That would probably end poorly, as they do. But once would make for quite a story. Yeah, Nick, I imagine going to a party with a bunch of porn mongers would make for a great story. All right, we're at home stretch here. Twitter. Matthew Price said the rules of the game. It's one of these... upstairs, downstairs kind of movies, like Downton Abbey, basically, like most of Downton Abbey. So huge society people, all their help, and just tons and tons of people in a great big estate. That would be cool. James from Cinema Sites in Texas said the first party in Metropolitan, which I am remiss to say I have not seen.
I have not seen.
Oh, James, you stumped us both. Well,
great.
Yeah. Rich Watson in New York City said... He on Twitter said the toga party from Animal House. So there we go. Folks, you've got a friend. Whew. Allison in North Carolina, the nerd vampire herself, said one of the parties from Midnight in Paris. I don't know why I never thought of that.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're awesome. Or any day on the ship in Pirate Radio.
Oh,
you got some good music there, so that's always a winner. John Ander in Sweden said, maybe I'm late to the party. Well done. Nice play on words. But for some reason, the one that comes to mind is the last night Ed Norton is free in the 25th hour. Have you seen that?
I have. Long time ago.
Yeah. Like big, like raging New York club party. I've always wanted to be at one of those. I always feel out of place, though. I'm not good at clubs.
Especially New York clubs.
Oh, man.
They take clubbing to a whole new level.
Yeah. Jessica, Velvet Cafe, also in Sweden, said, I'd love to join a hobbit party in the Shire. At a peaceful time, dancing, eating, drinking all night, and bare feet.
If you're going to dance all night, do it in bare feet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Finally, Bubba Wheat said the impromptu party at the end of Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Where else would you get to be around all those cartoon characters at one time? Well done, Bubba. He does a site called Flights, Tights, and Movie Nights, so go check that out. I think he's actually launching a podcast of his own soon. There's a whole truckload. Now, you said one of those was yours.
Empire Records.
And good call to both you and whoever it was that already picked that. So why that one?
Damn the man. Save the Empire. I mean, I must have watched that movie 100 times in my high school days. Loved record stores. Lived in a small town in Sarnia at the time. And, like, just lived for the times that my mom would let me come to Toronto and go to Tower Records. So, to me, like, the thought of working in one and playing in one and then having a big party, you know, on the rooftop of one, I just thought it was the coolest thing imaginable. And, like, they had cool characters, you know, the quirky guy, the hot guy,
the bald girl.
Yeah, I mean, who didn't, you know, Liv Tyler. I mean, I may or may not have bought the outfit that Liv Tyler wore. And, you know,
there's a photo somewhere, I'm sure.
Probably, much to my mother's chagrin, you know, tried to pull that off. So I always thought that was awesome.
That was an awesome party. Like, you had them playing on the roof, which was always cool. It's kind of a snapshot now, because that would never happen. First of all, you would never find a record store that big in a town that small anymore.
No.
Because it's not a city. It's a smaller area. You can barely find a record store that big, period, anymore. Like, Toronto, we're down to two.
Yeah.
When at one time we had, like, half a dozen.
Yeah.
And the people who work there, they're not as quirky as they used to be, you know? It's not that kind of thing. And, of course, in that party, it's at the end of Rex Manning Day, or is it the next day?
I think it was at the end of Rex Manning.
Yeah, because it's all in a day.
She never took that skirt off.
No, that's right. Yeah. So it's at the end of Rex Manning Day. It's been just a hard day for everybody, a weird day for everybody. You know, they get the whole town there. Now, that would be a great party to go to. I don't know why I didn't think of that. And I think I need to watch Empire Records tonight, actually.
Yeah, and as I recall, they raised a lot of money. You know, they have the big jar. The big jar of cash.
Yeah.
They fix the sign.
Yeah, Nick goes and buys it. Spoilers for Empire Records,
yeah.
I guess.
Oh.
But yeah.
If you haven't seen it, screw you.
Yeah, exactly.
Come on.
That is a great call. I'm also going to listen to Sugar High later, because now that's in my head. My answer is a little stupidly more highbrow, but stay with me. So, it's not even really a great movie, but this is a cool thing. There's a movie from the 50s called Picnic, with Kim Novak is the only person who comes to mind in it. And it takes place on Labor Day weekend in this small southern U.S. town, where this stranger, like, rolls in, and he endears himself to this one family who kind of looks out for him. And there's two daughters and the mother and everything like that. And the whole town is gearing up for this Labor Day picnic. I swear to God, dude, the picnic is 1 hour of this movie. It's like a half hour intro, 1 hour of picnic, and then half an hour to wrap it all up. And this picnic is friggin' epic.
Okay.
There are races, there's food galore, there's music, there's just everybody's hanging out in the sun. The whole town is in this gigantic park. There's one shot which sticks out in my mind where the camera, like, pulls back and you just see, like, shelves and shelves and shelves of watermelon.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all cut in half. Like, it could be, like, the greatest watermelon ad ever. And like, everybody in the theater, I did get to see it in a theater. Everybody in the theater was kind of, like, going, just all of a sudden. So it's not that great a movie. It's very melodramatic, but it's got some cool moments. It's just, it feels like the most epic picnic ever. And I wanted to go to it by the time it was all over. I wanted to do, like, the three-legged races, and there's, you know, there's all this dancing and stuff like that at the end. Oh, they crown a queen.
Queen of the picnic.
Queen of the picnic, okay. Yes, she comes. I swear to God, they're on a body of water. I want to say it's a river. And they, like, bring the queen in the boat.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's like there's, like, you know, kind of like a prom queen, and then they, like, hustle her off to get her in the boat, and then she, like, makes her entrance on the boat.
Because every picnic needs
exactly.
a queen.
Exactly. Yeah, now you want to go to that, don't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, I want to be the queen of the picnic.
Well, who would? I want to be the queen of the picnic.
Maybe you can be.
Well, that's my choice for the party I want to go to. So just look at the trailer. I'm sure there's tons of images of this party. My question for the next episode, which is going to come kind of quickly, by the way, so do get your emails in a little bit faster if you can, is the next film we're talking about is going to be Star Trek Into Darkness, and it's a film that I've been desperately trying to find out as little as I can about. I want to go in very, very blind. And I want to know about people, films where they either just got in knowing nothing and they got surprised and everything went well, or just even people's effort to avoid spoilers. Like, I've heard of people who like cover their ears when there's trailers playing, or people who like run out of the theater, that kind of thing. I want to know, what's a film that you really, really tried to not spoil for yourself, and what did you do? Ryan at thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I'm matinee_ca, or Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. We will be right back after this to talk about this week's feature review, The New Slang, and the new slang this episode is The Great Gatsby. So we gonna dance until we drop. A little party never killed nobody. Right here, right now is all we got. A little party. The Great Gatsby is directed by Baz Luhrmann. It is adapted by Luhrmann and Craig Pierce. Adapted, of course, from the source novel by F. Scott Fitzgerald. It stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Carey Mulligan, Tobey Maguire, Joel Edgerton, Ella Fisher, and Elizabeth Debicki. There we go. In case you didn't study grade 11 English, The Great Gatsby is about a mysterious millionaire named Jay Gatsby. That, of course, is Leo. His neighbor is Nick Carraway, who is intrigued by this stranger and his whole world. And his obsession is Daisy Buchanan. That's Carey Mulligan, the woman who he once had a brief little, shall we say, moment with. And he has basically been pining after ever since. So, Kelly Cameron, what did you think of The Great Gatsby?
Okay. So, overall, I liked it. Yeah. Typical, I mean, in a lot of ways, typical Luhrmann. Takes it to a new level. I would say that it... it elaborates on what he does in Romeo and Juliet and Moulin Rouge, and if anything, actually makes them look simplistic by comparison, in a lot of the scenes, anyways. Very true to the novel, from what I remember of the novel, which, full disclosure, haven't read it in a really long time.
Yeah, we were just talking about this off air. I read it a few months ago, but even then, I was foggy. And you said, for you, it's been even longer than that.
Yeah, we're going back to, like, university days. But I'm fairly certain it was fairly true to the novel. Yeah, I thought it was solid performances. And, hey, anything... My theory with these types of movies is anything that gets younger people in to expose them to a classic, especially a literary classic, is a win in my books, even if it's an epic fail.
Yeah, yeah, and it's... It's done reasonably well. I've kind of saw a few little cracks in it, but by and large, I had a good time and I enjoyed it, and I would recommend it. I think this is a book that's been adapted into 3 movies coming into this, plus a TV version. So now this is kind of the fifth kick at the can, and I really just think that it's one of those pieces of work that doesn't adapt well. That it works beautifully on the written page and where your imagination can just go places and fill it in and catch all these little nuance of character moments that the film doesn't really get into, but that just doesn't translate to the screen completely. So with that in mind, I kind of think that this is as good as it's going to get.
Yeah.
You know, so there's that. You strike me, like, we didn't really discuss this before, but you strike me as a fan of Baz Luhrmann, right?
Yeah, okay. I quite enjoy his work.
I wonder, though, and I am too, I even, to a certain extent, I even liked Australia, but I wonder if he's a little bit out of his element when he's forced to stay grounded, because whenever his films are allowed to get very imaginative and lavish and fanciful... he does extremely well, and certainly in this movie, like, anytime they're at a party or anytime he's doing tricks with, he does a lot of tricks with words in this movie. Like, we see text on screen and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
it's going full barrel. But anytime it's got to have these more human moments, these more genuine moments, it feels a little off. Did you notice that, or am I up a creek?
I think a little bit. I think also, too, because he's restricted to these characters that a lot of people know so well from the book, and he's trying to stay so literal to the text that he's trying to recreate moments that were created in the author's mind. So maybe that affected it a little bit.
But then I think about Romeo and Juliet, is, like, that was in his Red Curtain trilogy. He said that these were three films that used different things to express love. Music in Moulin Rouge, dance in Strictly Ballroom, and word, the written word in Romeo and Juliet. And he gave them a lot of life. And it's Leo again. It's the same guy. I don't know. Like, I just, part of me wants him just to play in that corner of the sandbox and just to do really imaginative stuff where he can just let his imagination, where he can just go off the leash as far as he wants. And not necessarily do this kind of story where we've got characters so hung up on loss, so hung up on just searching for something that they can't have. I think that's the thing, is that the hang up of this film is that it's Baz Luhrmann playing against his strength.
Yeah.
No?
I think a little bit. I mean, at the same time, probably for me anyways, I would think to myself, well, he's handled characters who are hung up on things well before, certainly damaged characters, hopeful characters that are hopeful against all odds. Like, those have been themes that we've seen over and over again in his movies, and I think that maybe you might think, okay, well, Gatsby falls into that category, but the rest of the characters in Gatsby play very much against that.
Yeah.
And I think that that's where he struggled. I think he got Gatsby pretty good, struggled with the rest of them.
Yeah. Now, that said, as far as what he did not do particularly, I don't want to be too hard on him. I want to say he didn't do that as well as I'd like. He still did it reasonably well. He still did it efficiently. What he did amazingly well is the look of this film. Mm-hmm. We'll start with the parties, because you kind of need to. We talked earlier about parties we want to go to. Lord knows I wanted to be at one of those parties.
Absolutely.
There, I don't know if you noticed or not, but a lot of cool 3D use with the confetti.
Yes.
And even just with the depth, like, you know, at this just massive humanity at these parties, you could just see how deep it all went. It was very clear that it was a practical shot. There were no, you know, computer-generated people, like patrons at this party.
Yeah.
And that was, I think, as well, where the music worked the best. They tried a few times to get some modern music in, and there's a few times where it felt a little bit bumpy.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly when they were at the party and they were playing that great R&B stuff, it worked fantastically.
Absolutely.
Were there any other moments where, like, the visual really kind of came through for you?
I would say, yeah, definitely the parties. The early sequences, I thought, where they did, like, the landscape shots, sort of introducing each of the venues that we would see, I thought were beautifully done. The polo shot comes to mind. It was gorgeous. Mm. And certainly the car, the yellow car.
Oh, yeah.
Gorgeous car. And any scenes involving the skyline, the New York skyline, I loved that. There was one where they panned back and you actually saw the men working on one of the buildings, and I thought that was a nice touch, because it's reminding you, you know, what era you're in.
Yeah, this is the 20s when Manhattan is still growing. Like, yeah. I think, I don't even think the Empire State Building is done yet in this film. I think they're working on it.
I don't think so. Yeah, it didn't look like it was fully done.
On top of that, like, on top of the grand scale, even in the small scale, the clothes in this movie are awesome. Like, everybody looks so good in this movie. Like, just the hair, the makeup, everybody. Like, every scene is visually perfect.
Oh, yeah. You've got nothing left untouched. Like, I think about that scene where he comes into Tobey Maguire's cottage and decorates it. And he's wearing, you know, like a lightly colored suit. And they brought in, like, the macaroons. And even the color of the macaroons just worked perfectly. And it was...
No, it was... you're right. I don't know if you caught this or not, but... because you said it's been a while since you read the book. But the sign that kind of serves as the thing that's watching over everybody in the Ashland that's in between West Egg and New York City, the sign that's watching over them all, it's actually kind of evocative of one of the pulp covers of The Great Gatsby.
Oh.
One of the covers of the book that I know of, it's women's eyes, because they're you know, up for like Daisy. But it's that blue tone. They've kind of got that expression on them. So it can't be an accident that sign looks the same as that very pulpy cover of the book, which I'm sure is like copies all over the world. So no, the look of the movie is certainly one of the reasons to see it on big screen.
Absolutely.
Which I was very, very happy we did. And in 3D. He does good things with the depth with 3D. The stuff that's coming out at you is mostly confetti.
Yeah, snow. And the words.
Oh, yeah, the words come out for you. Yeah, that is very cool. It was all very, very...
But yeah, there's not a lot flying at you, you don't like 3D, is good.
Yeah, it was very deliberate, and I do appreciate that very much. I don't know about for you, but for me, DiCaprio really, really nailed it in this movie. Mm-hmm. Especially, not so much in the early going where he's doing the Playboy thing, because, let's be honest, we've seen him do that.
Yes, many times.
Many times. Yes. You know, there's the cool shot where we first see him, and I think most of the theater let out a laugh because it's actually an absurd moment. And he holds up the glass. We've seen that guy. Where he really worked for me was in the later going, where we see how sad and how just out of sorts Gatsby is, and how much he's reaching for these things he can't grasp. In that half of the film, was where he really sold it for me. I don't know about for you.
I think so, and I think that's one of the things I love about Leo is that it's so easy to quickly write him off as the cute playboy guy with no, you know, acting talent or depth. And in fact, in that first scene when he holds up the glass, I don't know if you've seen the image, there's an image circulating around social media that references Titanic when he's holding up a glass. And he's aged a little bit, but otherwise it looks like they took the same bloody shot. Like, he's got that look down, you know, cute, look at me, I'm adorable, I'm holding up a glass. But then he always manages to surprise. Like, I find he always ends up going for the depth that you might not think he has. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that because it's good.
How did you like him with Carey Mulligan? Like, how'd you like their chemistry and that? Because that's kind of a complicated relationship too, right?
Yeah, and I thought he did. I thought he did a great job. She was very fragile, but also had, you know, a lot, as you say, a lot of complicated issues. But I think the overarching hopefulness of him, but also the pain behind this desire to get back to the past and to basically erase 5 years, which I think a lot of us have felt, you know, especially if we've made mistakes in our lives, relationships we'd like to forget, etc. You know, it permeated through like almost every look that he had at her, that he just really wanted to make those 5 years go away. And I thought that... there were a few interactions between them where I felt like you could sort of see in her face that she was getting that, and she was pained because she couldn't give it to him. Yeah. And some of those quiet moments I thought were really well done.
What really endeared me most of this film, because I'll be honest, the first 20 minutes or so, I wasn't really in it. When we meet Carraway and when we go to the first party with... it's not even really a party. It's just a bunch of people hanging out in her apartment with Tom and Myrtle. It wasn't doing it for me. It felt like a really, really thin, as it is. It's not like I'm not blaming the film. It's just, it's a kind of a curious place to start. It just, it didn't feel like it was bringing me into the right place. And then of course you get into like the lavishness and the cars and the clothes and the shirts and you know, the look of everything. But it was in that late going where, as I said, Leo is playing this part of, like you said, trying to erase the past and trying to get this thing that he can't get. That was what I thought this film did the best, was trying to capture the tragedy of The Great Gatsby, especially, you know, the green light off the dock symbolizing that thing we want that is just out of reach.
Yeah.
The learning the Gatsby myth that he's... First of all, that he's self-made, but that's not enough for him. He's got to trump up this story with things he never uses in his house and books he's never opened and that kind of thing. And even just back to Daisy, the whole thing where she gets into of trying to say, I never loved you, and knowing that that's not true. Like, that was actually, for me, where Carey Mulligan really, really did well.
Yeah.
'Cause you can see that she wants to say that. She can't, because she knows it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
That part of the movie for me, that last hour, you know, for us, from 11:30 to 12:30 at night.
That's when it hit home.
Yeah, on a weekday. Well, that was the thing. Like, I was kind of fading a little because it was a long day. And as I said, it was 11:30 to 12:30. But I was still so in it. Because of that part of it, like, no, yes, no.
Yeah, no, I think definitely. And it's a hard, it's very emotional because you're watching this person who basically has everything that most people think they want in life. And what he really wants is at times both so simple and so unattainable. And it's painful to watch. And yeah. I think it's the same for the Daisy character because she knows that to have what she wants, it's again, so simple. All she has to say is that she never loved the other, you know, she never loved him, but at the same time, so impossible. Yeah. And it's that being in that situation where something you want is just out of your reach. And I think that they did a really good job with that. And it definitely kept me.
And it's crazy too, because like, you know, this is more of the story than the film, but they sell it very nicely. Daisy too. She has everything a person could want. She's got a husband, she's got a daughter, she's got a great house of her own.
Yeah. You know, she's got nice clothes.
Yeah, she's got great clothes. She's got a room with white curtains that billow in the breeze. Oh no, it's like seriously, that whole end of the film, which I think is far more important than the lavishness, is where I think actually this film really, really works. I almost think it's underrated, that part of this movie. Because I kind of felt that our audience was getting a little shifty.
Yes.
In that
moment. But it was also very late.
No, but I think they wanted more parties.
They may have, yeah, because I mean the parties dwindle. The parties dwindle and it becomes, you know, a story about the relationships.
Yeah.
But that's not that the party scenes weren't gorgeous, but yeah. I think you need that emotional core.
I need a party where a guy, you know, just conducts Rhapsody in Blue with fireworks going off over a lake.
Yeah.
I need to be at that party.
Yeah, I don't know why those don't happen more often.
Me neither. I need some of those shirts too, that's for sure. Well, we end our reviews with what I like to call the souvenir. And my souvenir is just a little touch, and it's a fantastic touch. It's when we finally meet Gatsby at the ball. Confetti's been coming down for what seems like hours, and people are just covered. Like, Nick has got it just all over him. Jordan's got like whole pieces that are like as big as butterflies in her hair and stuck to her shoulder, and they're just covered. But the touch I love and what I'd like to keep and what kind of says so much about the oddity of this party is that Gatsby doesn't have a single piece on him. Everybody else is just covered head to toe in shiny confetti. He does not have a glimmer on him. His suit is clean as hell. His hair is pristine. I loved that touch. It's that very subtle visual cue of the mysteriousness of this guy and the whole ridiculousness to the parties that he throws. That I loved that, and I would keep that and just watch it over and over if I could.
I feel bad because I'm going to use a line, it's a line from the book, so it's not.
That's all right. But
I think the moment when the two of them are so Daisy and Gatsby are dancing together, and Daisy says, "I wish I could have done everything in the world with you."
Yeah.
And
she sells it. It's a great moment. Yeah. Like that room is fantastic and they're dancing. I was like, I don't even dance, but I would have got up and danced.
Absolutely.
At that moment. And because how do you hear that and not want to?
Exactly. So. And I think that for anyone who's ever, you know, lost a love and you have that feeling of all the amazing experiences you've had after that, wishing they had been with that person. And
it's very therapeutic, really, I'm finding.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm glad I could do it. Very good.
Very therapeutic.
We can move to the couch if you want. You know, I can. There we go.
Pour my heart out.
Yes, we do rate, which I know is bringing fear to your heart, speaking of therapy, on a scale of 1 to 4 stars. So I'm going to put you on the spot. Kelly Cameron, what do you give Baz Luhrmann's The Great Gatsby?
I'm going to go with 3.
Very good. I'm going to go with a 3 as well. As I said, that beginning, I wanted a little bit more, and I want him to kind of find the balance between the fantastical and the human, but this is very handsome. In the late going, it gets really, really awesome. And just about every performance in this is killer. The one other thing I was thinking about, like, as a takeaway was Elizabeth Debicki, the girl who plays Jordan. This is like her first major role. First of all, she's awesome. Second of all, she's stunning.
Yeah. And very tall.
She's huge.
Incredibly tall.
You know, like, she's hanging around like Maguire and whatnot, and just towering over them. Like, you can kind of see that everybody's standing like 2 steps ahead of her just to look like they're reasonably close in height.
Yeah.
And then she's still taller. But no, I look for all of these things You're right. Yeah, 3 out of 4 for sure. Hey, maybe we're crazy. Maybe we're underselling it. Maybe we're overselling it. Let us know. Ryan@thematinee.ca. Twitter, where I'm matinee_ca, or Facebook. And we will be right back after this to turn the record over and play the other side. So come on back. A stranger thing would never change my mind. I gotta take it on the other side. Take it on the other side. Ordinarily, I let the guest begin with their other side, but I'm going to start with mine this time around just to make things a little bit different, and also just because there's a musical cue in between the two, and I want to use the music from Moulin Rouge because it's just so much better.
Absolutely.
So there we go. Well, my choice for the other side as a double feature for The Great Gatsby comes from 2008. It was directed by David Fincher, and it is The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, starring Brad Pitt and Cate Blanchett. Now, on paper, which I guess you didn't realize, I don't know if I've mapped it out to you or not, but on paper, the double feature is the F. Scott Fitzgerald double feature because he wrote the short story that The Curious Case of Benjamin Button is based on. The two films don't have a boatload in common.
No.
So, first of all, did you? I hope you watched it for this. Otherwise, okay.
I did.
Had you seen it before?
No.
You hadn't seen it before.
I had not. Okay. To be perfectly honest, it did not interest me.
Okay, and so now that you've seen it, what'd you think? Still didn't interest
It still didn't interest
Okay,
me.
That's okay, because you know what?
I wanted to like it.
That's fine, because well, here's the thing: is the first time I saw it, I was only okay with it. I was like that's all right, and I came away from it very dissatisfied. And then I watched it again, and actually I think I watched a whole bunch of special features that kind of talked about like both the story and things within the actual film, and I ended up liking it like a whole lot more.
Okay.
So it was really, really weird. Like, I am the twerp who tells people there's more there, watch it again, you know. And actually I don't even get into context, I just kind of fluff it off like that and people hate me for it. But this was a moment where I took my own advice and I actually dug it a lot more. I think actually one of the things, aside from the fact that they're both Fitzgerald, that actually brings the two films together quite nicely is how sad these stories are.
Mm-hmm.
How much we're talking about people who are pretty damaged.
Yeah.
Certainly with Button, it's a little bit more out of his control because he's facing more of a physical restraint than it is, you know, society or behavior or anything like that. But it is also something to do with how he was brought up, because he was brought up as a senior citizen, because he lived in a senior's home, he was surrounded by death and by quiet, and where, you know, most children are just like boundless energy and hanging out with other kids that are boundless energy, he was with people who just, you know, don't want the talking to raise a level above this or that kind of thing. So was none of that sitting like grabbing
you at
all?
Oh no, I mean, that's the thing. I found it a fascinating film. I thought it was extremely well done for what they were trying to do. I found elements of it to be absolutely heartbreaking, you know, especially in the quote unquote damaged vein, because, you know, that he was facing so many obstacles. And again, you've got these characters who want something that seems so simple, like they want to love each other, and they've got all these, you know, crappy obstacles in their way. For me, it was just too long. Just too long.
Yeah.
And at times a little creepy. But no, I can absolutely respect what they were doing.
Yeah.
So I appreciated that.
What did you think of another moment that actually kind of has stuck out with me since I've watched it a few times, is when he kind of first sees Daisy in a passionate capacity, like around the time she's like early 20s. Well, the first time it's like actually Cate Blanchett and it's not a little redhead girl. I also, by the way, just realized that both of these stories have women named Daisy in the forefront.
There's our similarity.
Fitzgerald had a thing for daisies. I don't know.
And little redheaded girls.
And little redheaded girls, yes. But what did you think, like, the first time that she's an adult, and he doesn't know how to, again, he doesn't know how to act like a fun-loving 20-year-old. Like, did that part kind of catch on with you at all? He goes to the party where she's with her dancing friends, and he can't get in there and mix with them?
Yeah, and it was kind of painful, because you've got this person who has known her for many years in one way or other and really wants to wants to get in there and just doesn't know how. It's like it takes social awkwardness to a whole new level, basically, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Understandably so. And my heart went out to him for the entire movie because, you know, I felt like she was almost, especially in that scene, a little bit blasé.
Yeah.
Like a little bit like, meh, you know. Like,
yeah, I got these guys over here. They're these dancer guys.
And you know a lot of guys have felt that way, right? Especially in a club. Like they want to go talk to a girl and she's just off with, you know, five other guys and it's nice guys finish last syndrome, but like here's poor Button who's not only the nice guy but also has, you know, a series of other disadvantages. So yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Well, yeah, doesn't one of the guys say something like, so I hear you know her grandmother?
Yeah, something
he's
like that.
Yeah, exactly.
But they don't know that, you know, in a couple of years he's gonna look like young Brad Pitt.
Exactly. So. Yeah, exactly. It's funny because when I rewatch movies, I tend to kind of latch on to something different every time. And you mentioned about the loves of our lives that can kind of shape us and can kind of maybe screw us up, and you know, we want to go back and do things differently and that not. And in the one thing I noticed this time when I watched it, and I don't know why I never really thought about this properly before, is Benjamin Button's first true love, as short-lived as it is the Elizabeth Abbott character, the one who's played by Tilda Swinton.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to thinking to myself, how would it shape a person whose first love was an older woman? Because he, at that time, he would have been approximately 19 or so, 18, 19, thereabouts. We've got a person here who, first of all, an older lover is going to change your outlook. If you're 18 or 19 and your first love is, I don't know what she is at the time, let's say she's late 30s, I think she's even older.
I think so.
You're not gonna approach love or even just approach relationships or sex or any of it the same as you would is if your first love was somebody your own age or even younger.
Right.
And that shapes him completely. And it's something that he'll never get over. And on top of that, of course, she's treating him like he's older.
Right.
It was something that fascinated me. I'd never really thought about it before. It's very much like what Gatsby goes through with Daisy, of wanting to have seized that moment and just living with regret. I don't think that Button lives with regret, but he certainly lives with like a different outlook of women and just love and sex in general.
Right.
And you were saying the fact that also on top of everything, it was with a married woman.
Yes.
So it wasn't.
And he had, you know, met her while she was with her husband.
Yeah. So it's. That's telling. Like, you know, what's the old saying? Like, if you're with a married person, there's no question of what they're in it for.
Right.
So I don't know if he caught that, or if he did, maybe that's what messed him up. Maybe the fact that the first person who was really with him
didn't love him. Yeah.
That'd screw him up for sure. I swear to God, every other time I've watched that movie, I've just kind of shrugged that part off. And this time I was just really, really caught by it.
Hmm.
So I don't know. So was there, like, you know, as much as I love this movie, was there anything that you especially didn't like, or you were wondering, why is Ryan making me watch this? Or for that matter, anything that, like, you saw in it that you maybe saw in Gatsby or vice versa?
Honestly, the only thing I really didn't like was the length. And, you know, by about 3 hours, I was like, why is Ryan making me do this? I want to go to bed.
You know what's funny? Both of these stories are short. Like, Gatsby's like a 200-page book, not even.
Yeah.
Button's a short story. I don't know why, as much as I enjoy them, I don't know why they take over 2 hours.
Yeah.
To tell these stories.
And that's the thing, I didn't feel like it needed to be quite that long. It had a lot of really great moments in it, but I just felt like it didn't need to be quite that long. But no, nothing actually really stands out that that I disliked about it.
That's good. So, okay, so I don't like it when I make my guests completely go through hell. So,
yeah, no, it was just too long.
Yeah, well, for me, kind of the takeaway for Benjamin Button and why I think that it works well with The Great Gatsby, I get to lean on Fitzgerald and his themes of youth and loss, especially. Even when the loss isn't even actually there, even when the loss is just perceived, sometimes that can be even worse than actual loss. Like, you know, both of these people lose people. Like Gatsby's in the book, he's got his father still. That was one thing they did cut out of the film.
Right.
But he's got no family. Button's been abandoned, and he loses all sorts of people along the way because all these people are older than him.
Right.
But they still have an awful lot going for him. Button's getting younger.
Yeah.
You know? So
yeah, he's doing real well.
But both of these characters and both of these stories are very, very heavily on mistakes we've made and wanting to go back to the past and, you know, do our youth right with hindsight. And, you know, Button gets to do it going forward because he's got a younger body. But that's the thing. I think that they both work very well in that respect, even though, you know, combined, they're like 5 hours worth of film.
Yes, you've got to commit a lot of time to find these similarities, yeah. But yeah. It might be worth it.
Exactly. Well, hang on, it's just a moment. We'll be right back after this with Kelly's Choice for the Other Side, coming up next. You see, I've forgotten if the green or the blue. Right away, the thing is, what I. Your choice for the other side was kind of a gimme. It was actually kind of the starting point when we thought about what movies we were going to choose. Your film, of course, is from 2001. It is also directed by Baz Luhrmann. It is Moulin Rouge. As I mentioned off the top, you're a theater nerd and a musical nerd and a Broadway nerd. This must have been just like right down, like right over the plate for you the first time you saw it.
Absolutely. I mean, it. Actually, it's funny. The first time I saw it, I almost walked out.
No.
Which is, I mean, yeah, and I'm so glad I didn't.
But wow.
That the can scene, like the very first scene in the Moulin Rouge.
Yeah.
Okay, so part of why I don't like 3D is because I do have a tendency to get motion sickness. Mm. And like, you know, Blair Witch Project couldn't do it. So when they start spinning around and everything, and then he's doing all those fancy, you know, things with the camera, and I was just like, I'm out. I can't do this. Like, I don't know what this guy is trying to do, but he's gonna make me sick. But then as soon as it cut to Satine and she came out singing her first song, I was hooked. And I actually went back, I think, and saw it 3 more times at the movie theater. Just closed my eyes if I was getting nauseous. So it was, yeah, total home run. I mean, it combined everything I love, plus it had 2 of my favorite actors in it.
Just to sort of shift this for a second or two from the film to you, were you already into musicals at the time, or was this kind of like, was this in the middle of your appreciation for it, or did this lead to your appreciation for it?
Oh no, I was already.
You're already obsessed.
Into it. Okay. Absolutely, was obsessed from the age of 5.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah. Well, I was just thrilled to see other people becoming obsessed.
Right. Well, that's the thing is, a couple things. First of all, on a grander scheme, I kind of feel like the modern musical, like, and I count this as the front marker of the modern movie musical. Mm-hmm. There's one or two in the 80s or 90s, but they're not really that good.
No.
So there's this long, like, 20-year gap between, like, All That Jazz and this, where there really wasn't much, or if there was, it wasn't much good. From there to this year, so 13 years now, or 12 years, I kind of feel like it has set the standard for what a movie musical is supposed to be, and that directors have been trying to hit this bar, and they keep missing it.
Yeah.
In a lot of respects. Like have any other musicals like come up to that kind of level for you?
Chicago's the only one that came close.
Right.
Right? I mean, I thought Chicago was very well done. Most of the other ones have not even come close to the bar.
Yeah.
And I think one of the best things that Moulin Rouge had going for it, you know, as a girl who probably forced 5 or 6 guys to sit through it, was the fact that it was current music.
Yeah.
Like, they really did something neat there because they took, well, current, I mean, 60s and onward maybe, but they took, you know, music that some people who are not into musical theater would know.
Yeah.
And they integrated it so well into the film.
Yeah,
so.
Like Nirvana and Queen and Madonna and
the Beatles.
Yeah, there's tons. And it's actually kind of funny that you mentioned the music because, of course, that is a musical, but I felt like that was one of the things I was kind of missing a little bit with Gatsby, was that approach to the music and how well it worked into the story. For instance, you know, I was sat down on the couch with my editor wife and shown a shot by shot, this is why the Roxanne Tango is an awesomely edited sequence.
Yes.
But it's also just the fact that they took Roxanne and turned it into a tango. I kind of wish that Gatsby had more of that. They tried it a little bit, like they did something a little cool with Crazy in Love.
Yeah.
That was about it. Everything else was either subdued or out of place. And I do, you know, obviously Gatsby's not a musical, but I do wish that they'd done that more. Was there anything that jumped out at you when you rewatched it for this show for the millionth time?
I'm not sure much would jump out at me at this point. Though
you could probably sing the whole thing for us.
Yeah, I don't think that you'd get a lot of repeat listeners if I start singing. But I could.
Right.
You know, yeah, absolutely. I could recite that film probably. But no, I think just in comparison to Gatsby, definitely the message of hope. Because, you know, they reference that Gatsby is one of the most hopeful people, you know, that Carraway's character had ever met, and I think that that was a big message in Moulin Rouge, was this message of, you know, hope and love and the bohemian lifestyle.
Right.
And I noticed a lot of parallels.
Yeah,
there.
No, and they, and you know, the lavishness of them, like again, visually,
mm-hmm.
like your eyes would be just melting out of your head by the time those films are done because
yeah.
they're just so stunning. Again, kind of coming off the screen, As you all know, there's been a great trend over the last 10 years, maybe a little longer, to make jukebox musicals
mm-hmm.
on Broadway. And by and large, they haven't worked. I'm going to say the success to non-success ratio is 20-80.
That's probably fairly accurate.
Is this is probably a better sign of a jukebox musical done right.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. I mean, there's a few purists, musical theater purists, that don't like it because combination of factors. I mean, some just don't really like Lerman. Some
okay.
don't really like film. So, well, I mean, then, you know, that's not that's hardly
yeah.
even fair. But
I'm not talking to them.
Yes, they're, you know, whatever. They only like it if it's, you know, live on stage. It was just the singing. It was that, you know, they weren't adequate singers.
Okay.
I mean, but you know what? They weren't bad.
No.
And I mean, it certainly wasn't on a level
we've seen
of
worse.
Crow.
Right. Yes.
on Les Mis. But no, I think that something like that is exactly where a lot of the jukebox musicals today don't hit the mark. Like it, you know, it combined a wide range of material, a wide range of song, and each song was picked perfectly. Like it fit perfectly.
Whereas a lot of jukebox musicals are just trying to,
they're just rammed in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, how many can we fit in and where can we fit them in? And it's totally irrelevant if it works or not. And
yeah.
I think that's where they kind of fall flat.
Yeah.
So.
The one thing I kind of do wonder now that we've had two films come after Moulin Rouge and neither one of them have been as good. But to be fair, that movie is fan-friggin-tastic.
Yeah.
Is I kind of wonder now if it's going to be the film that Baz Luhrmann is trying to outrun. He took a long time in between it and Australia. Australia itself was 5 years ago, and now
yeah.
we're here with Gatsby. I kind of wonder if it's become so much a part of his identity in that trilogy of films, has become so much a part of his identity. If it's just, how do I top that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely possible. I think with Gatsby, he might be coming certainly closer than Australia, and there's
yeah.
a lot more similarities, especially the party sequences. Like, I mean, you practically have the Can-Can girls, only they're dressed slightly differently. But that movie, I think that movie ended up being better than anybody expected it to be. And maybe even underappreciated when it first came out, and more appreciated
that.
With, you know, more years.
Yep.
Maybe
Gatsby
will
be
like
yeah.
that. I don't think Australia is going to be. It's been five
no.
years. I would say that that's probably where it's going to stay.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that that's probably going to be the one that he's always trying to beat.
I think that's actually a good takeaway from Moulin Rouge, like to kind of put a stamp on it, is that I do remember at the time it was loved and hated.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't really pay much attention to Rotten Tomatoes, but I believe at the time it was at a 50%.
I think so.
And even right now, like I kind of glanced at it when I was watching it, and even right now it's only down at like 72.
Yeah, and then a lot of people who hate it really hate
oh,
it.
Oh yeah.
Like
yeah,
don't
yeah.
ask them to even try
no.
and sit through it again.
No, and I kind of feel like that's one of those things that that the passage of time and everything like that, it helps. And you're right. Maybe that's the kind of thing that as people rewatch Gatsby and a younger generation watches Gatsby, and that's probably going to be their introduction into it. I guarantee you there are going to be a lot of mucked up papers
yes.
because they're going off that instead of reading the book.
Gatsby was handsome.
Yes, he
was handsome.
What about his dad? yeah, I think that that's the thing, is that it's... it's something that we kind of need to let breathe. And maybe that's the whole thing with his work, because Moulin Rouge wasn't liked at the time. Gatsby, not like I really kind of paid too much attention to what other people are saying, but it's only kind of coming down the middle.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, it's being talked about everywhere. It's being hyped up like crazy. Yeah. Spend Your Summer, The Summer of Gatsby. Yeah. But it's not getting, you know, A's across the board.
No.
In 5 or 10 years, maybe we'll be buying box sets.
It's entirely possible. Well, there we go. Three great movies. It's episode 84 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back. We're on short rest to the next episode. Come on back Monday, May the 20th, 1 week, not two, for episode 85. We'll be talking about Star Trek Into Darkness. Kelly these days is most prevalent on Twitter talking about a lot of theater stuff, but a great litany of things, really.
Coffee.
Coffee and the lack thereof. Yeah. Where can people find you on Twitter?
At BroadwayBabyTO.
Very cool. I am at thematinee.ca. The site is thematinee.ca. For more podcasting content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Listen, Apple's podcasting app, Stitcher Radio, Blueberry, and the iTunes Store, all of which give you handy ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on Gatsby, Moulin Rouge, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, or your adventures in trying to avoid spoilers can be left in the comment section. You can email me, ryan@matinee.ca, or you can find me on Twitter, ryan_matinee_ca. Any final thoughts before we sign this caper off?
I don't think so. No. Thank you for having
me. You did very well for your first... You were talking like you might want to do this for yourself?
I think I might, yeah. More of like a couch therapy session kind of thing, I think. Because that's where I tend to get most of my material from, is my own personal damage.
Well, you've done well for a first-timer, and I do owe you now, so if you want to guess,
all right.
I'm on there. But awesome. Until then, for Kelly, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at next time.